Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's special election series. Every Wednesday through the day after the election on June 5th, we will air a special Your Call focusing on the mayoral race, propositions, and ranked choice voting. Early voting has already started. Be sure to vote for three different mayoral candidates. If your top choice does not get 50%, your second choice might win. Please spread the word about ranked choice voting. And if you're not yet registered, you can register and vote on site right now at San Francisco City Hall. Today, we are joined by San Francisco Supervisor and mayoral candidate Jane Kim. She is the first Korean-American elected official in San Francisco. In 2006, Jane Kim was elected to the Board of Education. She later served as president of that body. In 2010, she was elected to represent District 6 on the Board of Supervisor. That district includes South of Market, Mission Bay, the Tenderloin, Civic Center, Treasure Island, and Yerba Buena Island. Her district has the highest proportion of the homeless population in San Francisco and a high concentration of tech companies. Supervisor Kim has championed many progressive causes, including making City College of San Francisco free for residents. She authored the ballot measure to increase San Francisco's minimum wage to $15 an hour, and she is one of the authors of Prop C. This is a measure on the June ballot that would make early childhood education universal and affordable. If she becomes mayor, Jane Kim says she will declare an immediate state of emergency on homelessness, and we will ask her about that. Jane Kim has been endorsed by many organizations, including the Sierra Club, SEIU Local 1021, the California Nurses Association, the San Francisco Tenants Union, the Rose Pack Democratic Club, SF Bernie Kratz, and others. And Supervisor Jane Kim joins me in studio. Hi, Supervisor Kim. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. It's very nice to be here again.
Well, it's great to have you. This is such an important race. If you win and you run again, you could be mayor for 10 years. So I want to get a sense of how you're thinking right now. So San Francisco is making international headlines about inequality. The average income of the top 1% is about $3.6 million, which is 44 times the average income of the bottom 99%. Mm-hmm. Average home, $1.25 million. Mm-hmm. A one-bedroom in my neighborhood near the Upper Haight is going for $4,000 a month. Mm-hmm. We've got a homeless crisis, a long shelter list, massive wealth, massive suffering. How do you explain how we got here?
So San Francisco has the fastest growing income gap in the country between the rich and the poor and a shrinking middle class. So in 1990 in San Francisco, the middle class, and we define the middle class as households making between $50,000 and $150,000 a year, so a very large group of individuals, the middle class made up close to 50% of San Francisco's population. As of 2012, which is the last year I have a data point, we dropped to 33%. And my guess is even over the last 6 years, we've dipped below 30%. Now, that is a large cohort of folks that can no longer live in our city. And I think the biggest question facing our city today is who gets to live in San Francisco? Now, this trend is no different from the rest of the country. Through the 1970s, middle class Americans outnumbered those in the upper and low income bracket. 40 years later, the opposite is now true. Now, I think there's a number of reasons for this, but two very stark things that I've noticed over the last 40 years is our incredible divestment from housing and education. So, you know, there was a time in our country between 1940 and 1980 that HUD's budget was larger than the Department of Defense. And through the 70s, there was more public housing units than people on the wait list. Now, when Reagan came into office and he came under this guise of small government and government should do less and the market should do more, and he decided that the market should take care of housing, the poor, and the working class. And soon as he made that decision and HUD's budget was cut by 50% over three presidential administrations, homelessness began to emerge as an urban crisis in cities across the country, San Francisco, New York, L.A., you name the city. And now, over the last 5 years, we are seeing homelessness jump by 20-25% in most cities across the country.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you bring up HUD because, I mean, this is an analysis that needs a lot more attention. When I hear candidates talking about homelessness, you know, San Francisco obviously cannot solve this problem alone.
We cannot solve this problem on our own. It is a national crisis. And yes, you should hold the mayor and the Board of Supervisors accountable to addressing homelessness. But I wish voters would also hold our gubernatorial candidates, our presidential candidates, those that are running for Congress accountable as well, because when we decided that the market would take care of housing everybody, I think that's where we really went wrong. And I look at back of the envelope numbers because I negotiate with developers all the time, and it simply does not pencil out for them to build for the poor and the working class, and now in San Francisco, the middle class as well. Mm-hmm. And we frankly need to subsidize this housing.
We've also seen a lot of changes over the past 10 years. Can you talk about what happened under Mayor Ed Lee? What criticisms do you have of some of the decisions he made mm-hmm. that got us to this point?
I'm not sure it's a specific criticism on the mayor, because this is something that we're seeing through the country. Wealth is just further concentrating in the hands of the few. And the more that you allow kind of laissez-faire economic growth, which is what we've been experiencing for the last 40 years, you're going to see wealth, again, further concentrate in the hands of the very few. You know, I really press upon both government and the private sector. And to the private sector, and the fastest growing sector, at least in the Bay Area, has been the tech community, is for them to examine how they pay their workers and treat their workers, and how do they treat their lowest paid workers. Contracting out, for example, your janitorial services, cafeteria workers, and security guard services is a race to the bottom. Who wins the contract? It's the contract that is the cheapest. And how do they do that? By paying their workers the least. So they are also contributing to this exacerbated economic divide between the rich and the poor, and the benefits that they provide. Do they provide commuter shuttle buses for their janitors, their security guards, and their cafeteria workers? Do those workers get the same benefits that their salaried programmers and engineers get? I think that this is a big conversation that we have to be having overall.
Benefits to workers, and what about benefits to the city? 48 Hills had a really interesting story about development and, quote, balanced growth. And they looked at the California Pacific Medical Center, and in January 2011, there was supposed to be this massive private development, and community groups got together and said, all right, in return, we want local employment, public transit, mm-hmm. pedestrian safety, affordable housing, accessible health care for this mm-hmm. project. Mm-hmm. Didn't happen. But what about tech? Because with the Twitter tax break, the one criticism of that is that there were not those kinds of benefits. It's like, you will be given a tax break, but in return, what does the city get for
mm-hmm.
this?
Mm-hmm. Just really quickly on CPMC, it's not entirely true. They did commit to a certain level of affordable housing and public transit. It may not have been as much as we would have liked, but they did make some commitments. And some of that funding is now funding streetlights and the Tenderloin and pedestrian safety initiatives in that area. You know, I generally think that people should enjoy paying their taxes, because that is our investment back into our city, our community, our state. It goes into funding our schools, our roads, our infrastructure. In 2011, we were in the depth of our recession, and we were cutting to the bone. It was incredibly painful. And when I was running in 2010, jobs were the number one issue that we heard about. Now, we had a major employer that was threatening to leave the city. Whether that would have happened or not, very difficult debate. And so we introduced a very narrow payroll exclusion on net new jobs that companies would create in the mid-market corridor, a corridor that had the highest commercial vacancy rate in the city. And they had to move into a building that had been vacant, historically vacant. So, for example, Twitter moved into the Furniture Mart building, which had been vacant for about 50 years. And Uber and Square moved in next door to 1455 Market, which didn't have historical commercial vacancy rate. So they're paying all of their taxes. Now, you know, it was an imperfect policy, and I think very few of us could have predicted the economic growth that followed. But it is true. I mean, when we generate a lot of wealth, part of how we distribute that more equitably is via progressive taxation policy. And I have followed up with that since. In 2016, we did an ultra-luxury real estate transfer tax, which voters thankfully passed. It generated $40 million last year. And with those funds, we were able to make San Francisco the only city in the country to make community college free for all of our residents, which I thought was such a great investment. I talked about how we've divested from housing. We've also divested from public education greatly. Mm. And we need to go back to investing in what I believe are the four pillars: housing, public education, public transportation, and healthcare. Those are the foundations which I think attack or address the growing economic divide and provide people with opportunities to succeed.
And as you've said, those services require money. And I'll ask mm-hmm. you about the $10 billion budget later in the show. Mm-hmm. But back to taxes. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you look at a company like Twitter, for example, when that company went public, Business Insider reports that it created 1,600 millionaires overnight. Mm-hmm. And so when companies go public in the Bay Area, Uber's planning to go public, according to reports, next year. So many more millionaires are going to be created. There's no way even someone making 200 grand can compete with that. Mm-hmm. So how do you think, how will you, if you become mayor, mm-hmm. deal with even more wealth that is coming to this mm-hmm. city?
Well, one, you know, a number of housing providers and homeless service providers are crafting a revenue ballot measure for November. It is an increase on the gross receipts tax of companies that make 50 million or more. And they estimate that it'll generate about $300 million for the city, and they want to dedicate it towards supportive housing for the formerly homeless, mental health care services, and other types of affordable housing. That is a pretty big contribution. Our last affordable housing bond, which we passed 3 years ago, was $310 million over the course of a decade. This is $300 million every single year. It's part of how we ask those who are doing well in our city to invest back. And I always tell companies, you know, this work is not altruistic. This is very selfish. I am safer. You are safer when people have housing. I am safer when people have access to affordable education and health care and child care. So, you know, I try to get companies to understand that it's in their benefit, too, to be part of a city where there is greater equity.
What about the decision-making process when a company comes to town? How are you going to deal with that as mayor? Are you going to have an open-door policy? I mean, who's going to be invited into your office? At the end of the day, that's what really matters.
I agree with you. I think that's one of the most important questions. You know, I hear allegations often on the campaign that certain people will own City Hall if certain candidates win. And I strongly disagree with that. It's not that certain people own City Hall. It's just that they get a special seat at the table. They get more access. They have more meetings. They get to contribute more, and their feedback matters a little bit more. I think what's important in the next administration is that everyone has an equal seat at the table, that no one is considered no one's voice is more valuable than another. And for me, I have thought a lot about how to ensure that. For example, lobbyists, which, by the way, some of them are very great people, you know, they have networks, they know how to work City Hall, and they, of course, work for some of the wealthiest interests in our city. How do we make sure that they don't have greater access because they can afford to pay someone to sit there all day and wait to meet with the mayor, the member of the board of supervisors, versus a small business owner who doesn't have the funds or the time to go to City Hall and advocate directly themselves? I think one of the things that I want to really look at is how City Hall can invest in organizing. You know, I came, my background is a community organizer, and I always remember someone telling me one, if you have a choice between funding services or organizing, you got to fund the organizing, because then the community is going to come back and fight for those services. And I think one of the things that we have to do is to help give people a voice and facilitate that process at City Hall so that we can ensure that we hear from more people. It has to be intentional. When you're laissez-faire about it, people with greater resources and wealth are going to be able to access you more.
Talking more about taxes and inequality, earlier this year you announced that you would introduce legislation to increase business taxes for companies that pay their CEOs vastly more mm-hmm. than the average worker. Mm-hmm. And the bill is derived from similar legislation in Portland, mm-hmm. Oregon. We're now getting a lot more information about the gap between CEOs and the worker. Mm-hmm. What's the status of that plan?
Yeah, so we have been working on this measure for the last year, and it's something that Portland had passed through. We hit a bit of a snag, though, when the Trump administration decided to no longer promulgate the rule that requires these public companies to disclose the median employee salary in a company and the salary and benefits of the CEO. Now, while we can determine the CEO salary and benefits, we were not able to get the median employee salary, so we decided to do it based off of the median San Francisco employee salary, and the measure would generate about $20 to $25 million a year. However, because, you know, we don't want a lot of competing revenue measures in November, we have decided to pull back and let the gross receipts measure, which will generate $300 million, move forward first.
I want to ask you a question about Uber and Lyft, because I know that we're going to get a lot of questions about housing and homelessness, and I want to make sure we have time for this one. So according to City Attorney Dennis Herrera, there are 45,000 Uber and Lyft drivers on our streets. Mm-hmm. We all know that traffic is just... It's unlike anything I've ever seen, even at noon, you know, going to the mission. People take about 170,000 Uber and Lyft rides in San Francisco every single day. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what went on behind the scenes? I mean, I know this is regulated by the California PUC, but what went on behind the scenes in San Francisco when Uber and Lyft came to town?
Well, SFMTA certainly tried to build a relationship with them and see how we could work together. It wasn't always easy, although I don't want to say they're a monolithic group. I think certain companies were easier to work with than others. But I think we really have our hands tied behind our backs. We can't regulate what we call TNCs. It's a relic of the California state constitution where the PUC gets to regulate all other transportation services outside of taxi cabs and buses. This includes limousines and airport shuttles as well. And, you know, some of the things that we'd like to do, for example, do a per-ride fee, like the state of Massachusetts or Chicago and Philadelphia, or cap the number of vehicles, for example, in San Francisco, we're not permitted to do. Now, Supervisor Aaron Peskin has introduced a gross receipts tax just on TNCs for November. I'm a co-sponsor of that. That is something that, you know, I think we are looking at and examining, but it is very hard when we, via the state, are not allowed to regulate. In fact, last year, the state legislature passed a bill that takes away a requirement that we had here in the city and county of San Francisco, which is that we require you to have a business license to drive in San Francisco as an Uber or Lyft driver. Sacramento last year came down and they said that law is no longer valid. They don't need to get a business license here in San Francisco. And so we have just further seen our powers to regulate erode here.
I was in a cab last night. And I asked the taxi driver what question he would want me to ask you. And he said, please tell Jane Kim that we make between $5 and $7 an hour now. We've done shows with Uber, Lyft, and taxi drivers on the same show, and none of them can get by in this market. Taxi drivers have been hit so hard because of Uber and Lyft. Now, if you become mayor, you'll have a major, major platform. In New York, over the past 5 months, four drivers who are financially strained have committed suicide. And in some cases, their family members said it was because of Uber and Lyft. Now, the New York Taxi Association is calling for a cap on the number of vehicles. They want app companies to be regulated. Lots and lots of things they're asking for here. Even though you couldn't implement these changes because it has to happen with the California PUC, you could use your platform to call for something like this.
Absolutely.
Would you do that?
I have long been calling for a cap on Uber and Lyft. By the way, I don't think that they're necessarily a bad thing in and of itself. I just think that there can be too much of a good thing. And we as a city have failed our taxi cab drivers for certain. And we need to figure out how to buy back the medallions because they are now worthless. And we have left people in incredible economic straits. And reading the article about the suicides in New York City were so disheartening. The one thing that the city can do is that we can do more to help our taxi cab drivers, and we absolutely we're responsible to do that because we didn't do our job in protecting them and helping them compete on this market. You know, Uber and Lyft they're cheaper because every ride is subsidized by a venture capitalist. The rider is not paying the full cost of that ride, and certainly the worker is paying for it too because they're not really making a fair wage either. In the long term, I hope that the state will really step up and move away from this contractor relationship. This is an employer-employee relationship. And so there's a number of things that I'm ready to advocate for. And finally, I do believe in a congestion pricing fee, which will certainly impact TNC drivers that come into the city.
What else can the city do for taxi drivers specifically?
I think one thing that we're looking at is what we can do around the medallions because they have become worthless, and I think that the city should buy them back. We're examining a number of different options. There is $4 million in overpaid parking tickets. Sorry, residents, if you double paid your parking ticket, but we have an overage of $4 million. And I know Supervisor Peskin and I are looking at how to best spend those dollars down. It could be looking at these medallions.
Today, it's a special Your Call election series. Every day through the day after the election on June 5th, we're airing a special focusing on the mayoral race, propositions, and ranked choice voting. And today, we are joined by mayoral candidate Jane Kim. In 2006, she was elected to the Board of Education. In 2010, she was elected to represent District 6 on the Board of Supervisors. If you have a question or comment for Jane Kim, what are you looking for in your next mayor? The next mayor could serve for 10 years. This is a very important race. Early voting has already begun, and be sure to vote for at least two, if not three, different candidates. If your top choice doesn't get 50%, your second choice might win. Please spread the word about that. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Join us on Facebook and ask a question there. I also want to ask you, Jane, about underfunded neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. We had three young women from the Bayview on recently, and they all want to go to college. Mm-hmm. And they talked about what it's like to live with gunshot noise on a regular basis, being afraid to leave the house, coming home from school. This is 5 minutes from our station right here. And you have to wonder, in a city like San Francisco with so much money, why is it that these neighborhoods are still so under-resourced? And what will you do to tackle that?
You know, it's not necessarily inequitable distribution of resources. I think it's that the city has to think about actually investing more in neighborhoods like the Bayview than other neighborhoods. We should be investing more in the public schools and public transportation system here. We should be investing more in services and organizing. We have a lot to do to improve public safety, but it is as you said, it is not evenly felt by all San Franciscans. There are many neighborhoods in San Francisco where people feel very safe. They don't worry about being shot or about gunshots coming through their neighborhood. And so in the case of neighborhoods like this, I would like to more greatly invest in after-school programs, violence prevention, employment training, things that actually prevent violence in the future.
And how will you do that exactly?
You can do that via our budget process. We, as you mentioned, we have a $10 billion budget. Now, it's not always fair to talk about the entire amount because some of it is tied up with the airport and our county health system, you know, the port. And but there is still discretion within this budget, and we can do a process where we invest more in the neighborhoods that need it the most.
Angela Alioto often talks about getting rid of waste. She talks about no bid contracts. She talks about the DPW, Parks and Rec. What areas of the budget do you see need to be dealt with when it comes to waste?
We have to deal with overtime. That is a huge budgetary problem here in our city. And if we need to hire more people to do it, to address overtime, then we absolutely should. And that means that more people have work. Right. More people have access to middle class jobs. City jobs are middle class jobs and benefits and pension. And I think the overtime problem is part of what is, you know, really hurting our city budget. There's certainly room for much more efficiency. There are departments that probably aren't as effective or as efficient as they used to be. Rules have changed. And then there are other departments that we need to grow greatly, like our street cleaning budget. I think we need to double the number of street cleaners and double the number of publicly monitored restrooms. And so that I think in a new administration, you're going to see a hard look being given to the way we fund city resources.
Today, we're speaking with Supervisor Jane Kim. She is running for mayor. Let's hear from Johanna in San Francisco. Hi, Jane. Johanna, welcome to the show. Hi, do we have Johanna?
Hi, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I appreciate you taking my call and this conversation with all the mayoral candidates. My question is about, I'm not sure if Supervisor Kim is aware of there's a draft proposal for basically what they're calling it is a stay-over program for families at a public school in the Mission, Buena Vista Horseman. It's a dual immersion K-8. Essentially, this is being put forth with the San Francisco Unified School District and Hillary Ronan and the school administration to start a shelter in the gym of the school, in the gymnasium. So my question is this something that she would support, and that is this a plan for, you know, addressing the acute need of the homeless in San Francisco, particularly in the Mission District, and how she feels about putting this burden on an already stressed public school system?
So one of the parents did actually reach out to me. I haven't seen the full details of the proposal yet, but I support the overall concept. I think our schools need to be neighborhood hubs and that they can certainly do more than just educating our students. And the city should be a part of funding those resources to make sure that schools are wraparound schools for the students and the families, but also for the neighborhoods as well. I do need to see the full proposal, its cost, who it would serve and how many people. But I was really heartened to see a community, you know, decide to take issues in their own hands and come up with solutions.
Thank you for the call, Johanna. Speaking of homelessness, Jane, your district includes the Tenderloin south of Market. It has the highest proportion of the homeless population in San Francisco. There's so many things happening in your district. Given your stance on these issues, you talk a lot about affordable housing, lack of shelters, temporary relief. What have you done as your time on the board to tackle these issues? Specifically, let's talk about the Tenderloin, because, I mean, when you go there after dark, it's, I mean, I've taken cabs through there after dark, and it's truly shocking. In some cases, you wonder if people are even alive on the streets. Some people are sleeping on tiny pieces of cardboard.
The Tenderloin is a neighborhood that our office has spent quite a bit of time in. And by the way, I have to say, the residents in the Tenderloin are amazing. I mean, some of the most organized tenants live in the neighborhood, and they come up with really creative ideas on how to solve issues. When I ran for office, there were three issues that came up when I was running in 2010. One is the need for more bathrooms. Two was Bodecker Park, the only multi-use park in the Tenderloin, which was unutilized and looked like a prison. And three was actually addressing the disproportionate number of liquor stores in the neighborhood and not having any grocery store, any full-service grocery store in the neighborhood. This is on top of the usual public safety issues. On the first, I spent a couple of years working with Public Works and the residents to devise what we now call the Pit Stop Program, which we launched in 2014. We launched three portable monitored toilets throughout the week, and they were a big hit. We saw a 60% reduction in steam cleaning requests in the neighborhood after we put these bathrooms in with monitors, because that was very important. And we saved 2,200 gallons of water a month because of the reduction in steam cleaning requests. We've now expanded the program to 18 pit stops, and I think we need a lot more. No one should have to go to the bathroom on the street, and frankly, very few people want to. So we should provide them a safe and dignified option, and no one should have to step over someone else's feces when going to work or to school. The second, Bodecker Park, we also spent several years raising the millions of dollars needed. We have completely renovated the park, and we have activated it 7 days a week with funding the Y and the Boys and Girls Club. And that park is amazing. It has completely turned that corner around. It is used by families and kids and seniors every single day. I am even stunned, actually, at how successful that park has been, but it has been through very intentional organizing again and investing in activation. The third, full-service grocery store. I was not able to fulfill that commitment that I made. I asked every single grocery store under the sun to come in, and no one wanted to come to the neighborhood. So the residents actually came to me and they said, you know what? We have 72 liquor stores in the neighborhood. Why don't we work with them? They're small business owners willing to be here and help convert them to healthy corner stores. And so we worked with the Department of Public Health, and we identified about six liquor stores that were willing to change their business practice for a period of time and pilot a program where they actually sold produce and vegetables and meat instead of cigarettes and liquor. And we gave them funding to do so. And this program has been incredibly successful. And you know, my favorite story is one of the small business owners said, you know, I used to think that my family and their ability to go to college depended on my ability to sell cigarettes and liquor. But now I've realized that there are families and seniors that live here that want to buy food and produce. And my mental health has improved because the type of customers that come into my store have changed. Now, in terms of public safety, we continue to tackle this issue. I represent the poorest residents of San Francisco, many of whom live in the Tenderloin. And we have invested greatly both in organizing and services. I'm also really proud of the fact that I have fought for and won more affordable and middle-income housing than any city supervisor over the last 7 years. And when there's a development on Mid-Market or in the Tenderloin, I always bring Tenderloin community residents into the negotiating room with me so that they can talk about what they would like to see in the neighborhood.
We have an email from Jeffrey in San Francisco who wants to know your position on designated heroin injection areas.
I support it. These we call them safe consumption sites because it's not limited to heroin. You know, this was a tough issue for me at first because the Tenderloin was always worried that if the city ever supported a safe injection site, it would be located in the Tenderloin. And I think our residents are wary of more services in that neighborhood given how many they already provide. That being said, I think a safe consumption site is incredibly important. It works in Vancouver. And, you know, what really moved me on this issue was when I heard that women are often assaulted after they get high, and that a safe consumption site in Vancouver has provided a safe space for women to be free from assault. And then eventually you build relationships of trust, you employ harm reduction techniques, and you get folks the services that they need. And that is the long-term goal of the safe consumption site.
Well, thank you for that question. Today, we are speaking with San Francisco Supervisor Jane Kim, who is running for mayor. Early voting has begun. If you are not registered yet, you can register and vote on site at San Francisco City Hall. We do have ranked choice voting. It's very important to vote for at least two different candidates. Do not vote for the same person because it won't count. If your top choice doesn't get 50%, your second choice might win. This is Your Call Special Election Series, and we'll be back after this.
And you are listening to this special program, Your Call, Rose Aguilar's interview with Jane Kim, one of a series of programs about the San Francisco election we're going to continue to do on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. till just after Election Day. If you appreciate this kind of drilling down, this opportunity to talk directly to the candidates, show your support now. Make a call, 800-525-9917 or klw.org. Matt Martin here with Your Call producer, Laura Wenis.
That's right, Matt. Your support makes it possible for us to do programs like this. We just went from a global issue, plastic in our oceans, to a very local issue. And what we want to do here is to continue to provide the conversations that are relevant to you. You make that happen. Go to klw.org or call us, 800-525-9917. Show your support.
800-525-9917. This is our public radio reunion. People from around the Bay Area giving their support. Thank you to Teresa Donovan in Oakland, Ellen Greenblatt in Berkeley, and Nick Hormuth in San Francisco. They all made their contributions in the last hour. Join them. KALW.org or 800-525-9917.
You know, when we're putting these programs together, we're thinking about what is really going to be useful to the listeners, what's important to you. And that's exactly what you can expect with community-supported radio. Keep it going. Go to KALW.org or call 800-525-9917. Keep this kind of programming on the airwaves.
Independent, local, community power. That is KALW. It happens with your support. We're going back to this conversation because it's important. If you value it, as you listen, make a call, 800-525-9917, or go to KALW.org and give your support there. You can see great thank you gifts. You can learn more about the station. That's where we're about giving you information, doing it in partnership with you. Thanks.
This is Your Call's special election series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are joined by San Francisco Supervisor and mayoral candidate Jane Kim. In 2010, she was elected to represent District 6, which includes South of Market, Mission Bay, the Tenderloin, and Civic Center. And she is running for mayor. If you have any questions for Jane Kim, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org, or you can watch us on Facebook, go to the KALW Facebook page, click the video, and then add your comment there. Jane, we have a couple of questions about conservatorships. And this has been getting a lot of attention lately because the Board of Supervisors recently approved an ordinance to give the city attorney authority over conservatorship proceedings. This is the process of forcing mentally ill people into treatment or putting them in the care of a guardian. And in the weeks leading to the vote, you said that you had many concerns with the way this was written. Where do you stand overall on this?
Well, there's actually two different there's an ordinance here at the city level, and then there's a state bill. So I have concerns about the state bill only because it hasn't been fully written yet. Conservatorship is a very heavy-handed tool, and as a civil rights attorney, I'm very careful about how we utilize it. And while I'm open to streamlining the process or expanding conservatorship, if we're going to do it and support it, I need to know exactly the details of how it's going to be done, and that has not been fleshed out at the state level. Now, on the local level, there was an ordinance introduced on giving the powers of working through the conservatorship from the district attorney's office to the city attorney's office. And I was fine with that. I think, honestly, either way, the system will continue to work. But for some who felt strongly that it should be within the civil division versus the criminal division, you know, that's why we moved it. There isn't a lot of data to demonstrate that there's going to be a major shift or difference because we did that. But, you know, I think it was just an administrative change that we've made.
We are seeing a lot of sweeps by Interim Mayor Mark Farrell. Where do you stand on sweeps?
Well, I support bringing people off the streets and into shelters or navigation centers or housing. What I have never supported is sweeping people off of one block and then having them land on another. And what often happens is one morning I'll get emails from one set of constituents complaining about an encampment. And then when they get swept, the next morning I'll get a series of emails complaining about the campments from a different set of neighbors. And frankly, it is very traumatizing also for those that are getting swept if they're not given a real bed. And so what I'll say about the sweeps that we've been seeing over the last week is that I don't support them because I haven't seen evidence that those individuals have come off the streets and into some type of care. And that is very concerning to me.
What about the program to offer people bus tickets to leave San Francisco? This got a lot of media attention earlier this year. Mm-hmm. Where do you stand on that?
If the bus ticket is taking an individual back to a family or a group of friends, of course I support that. And the way the program works is that the homeless outreach team worker works with this individual and then actually calls either the family or group of friends from where the person came from to ensure that this person has somewhere to go back to. It's not just about buying a bus ticket to go to anywhere. It's specifically about going back home. And there are a number of individuals that take that offer up, but not everyone does.
Mm-hmm. Right. And a lot of people quoted in these articles said they felt like they were just pushed out of the city. Take this bus trip, and they were pushed out.
Well, I think that's a very different program from the one that I understand that the city runs, which is that we actually call the family or group of friends or support network that this individual has, and then we purchase their bus ticket if they'd like to take it to go back home. I don't think that we should just buy people bus tickets to go anywhere. In fact, we learned that the state of Nevada did that to patients in their public health system and sent them to San Francisco. That's just shuffling the problem around. Mm.
You said that you will declare an immediate state of emergency on homelessness to ensure that Sacramento also takes up the fight alongside San Francisco mm-hmm. to end homelessness. Mm-hmm. Why is it important to declare a state of emergency?
When you declare a state of emergency, it releases funds that you don't always have access to, and it also allows you to streamline processes on construction, for example. I don't like single source bidding. RFPs, competitive RFPs are the way to go. But when you declare a state of emergency, you can cut through months of bureaucracy and red tape and get shelters or housing built more quickly. Now, as I said before, homelessness is not just a San Francisco issue. It is a national crisis. And at minimum, it is a statewide crisis. 20% of the nation's homeless count resides in the state of California. And San Francisco will not be able to solve this problem on its own. Not when Marin County refuses to have a 365-day shelter system. The state of California needs to step up, both in funding affordable housing, but also providing a minimum level of service in every single county.
Can you talk more about that? What would happen, let's say, if we had Well, and a lot of money is already spent on the homeless crisis. But as you know, there are a lot more older people on the streets, a lot more women on the streets. Mm-hmm. 10,000 people turn 65 every day in this country. Mm-hmm. Many are trying to get by on $1,000 a month, mm-hmm. and there's no way they can do that. Mm-hmm. I feel like this problem is going to get worse as people do not have a retirement or benefits.
Mm-hmm. And that is why I bring up, you know, the national role and how when our country did invest in building housing and subsidizing housing, homelessness was not a national crisis. And we need to go back to that. People simply do not earn enough to afford the cost of what it costs to build housing today. And housing is just not one of those goods. Like when I go into a store and I buy something, it is a very different type of good. It needs to be subsidized. It needs to be heavily regulated. And if you go into the business of housing, you go into the business understanding that it's a type of good that saves lives, is part of people's health and well-being and ability to work and raise a family. And so part of what San Francisco can do, it's a small role, is that we have to play our part in subsidizing affordable housing, because, you know, like I said, you know, in my district, it costs on average $450,000 a door to build new housing, whether it's for a formerly homeless family or for a market rate household. And so we simply have to invest more greatly in the production and preservation of housing.
We have an email from Andrew who says, I'm participating in an SRO, single room occupancy, family leadership training program. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks ago, we had a class on public speaking. We went to City Hall, knocked on every supervisor's door to ask more funding for affordable housing. Mm-hmm. Your staff greeted us openly and said, yes, Jane Kim supports the $15 million that's being proposed. Mm-hmm. It is not easy living in 180 square feet of space, mm-hmm. with a shared bathroom with two children. Mm-hmm. The fact that there are hundreds of families living in SROs in the wealthy city of San Francisco is just absurd, he writes.
Yes, so SRO hotels have long been affordable housing for our families as well as the formerly homeless and our seniors. And it's frankly unacceptable. And what many San Francisco residents don't realize is that the fastest growing segment of our homeless count, not just here in San Francisco, but in LA and New York as well, are working families. It's actually single mothers with children and jobs. And we have a huge moral conundrum here in this country and in cities across America when we can't afford to house people, or I'm sorry, when families that are working with children can't afford to live anywhere in the city that they work in. And so addressing homelessness as a crisis is a several prong approach. Now, the 3,000 4,000 people that people see sleeping in encampments, chronically homeless, usually also very sick, substance abuse often rampant in on the streets. That is a public health crisis. But we have close to 20,000 unique individuals that interface with our homeless support services system on any given year. And as I said, one of the fastest growing segment of this are children and families. And we need to vastly increase the preservation of rent control buildings. We got to strengthen tenant protections, and I strongly support Proposition F, right to counsel, making sure that people have an attorney in unfair eviction proceedings. And finally, we have to build more affordable housing and greatly expand our rent subsidy programs to keep people in place in their homes.
Right, because two-thirds of the people who live here are renters.
Yes.
And you support the Costa-Hawkins repeal?
Yes, I absolutely do. And by the way, one last thing is that we know that even affordable housing is out of reach for many of our families that live in SRO hotels. And so what we have done is now we're subsidizing rent subsidies within affordable housing units, so making them even more deeply affordable for families that live in SROs. Mm.
I want to briefly ask you about climate change and sea level rise, because what we hear right now is build, build, build. Mm-hmm. But we've done a lot of shows about sea level rise in San Francisco. We are expecting it. Actually, it's already happening in Mission Bay, where that's going to feature thousands of new housing units. Mm-hmm. Next year, we're going to have the Warriors Arena, 18,000 seats. Uber has bought a stake in two offices in that building area, according to Business Insider. We also did a show recently about Treasure Island and parts of SFO. Sinking by the end of the century, Treasure Island and half of the runways at SFO could be underwater, according to a report from UC Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
What about long-term thinking here? I mean, we want more housing, but what about long-term thinking?
I think that's one of the major challenges for elected officials, particularly via term limits, is that we're often very short-term in our thinking. We try to address the problem that's in front of us. Sustainability is a huge issue. We are not doing enough to address climate change in globally. And so I do think a lot about in terms of how we build. Now, it's true we have we're doing a lot of work to strengthen our seawalls, and we do have a bond coming up in November, which we hope that voters will support to strengthen our seawalls to ensure that with sea level rise that we're building up our land and ensuring that our neighborhoods, especially our newest neighborhoods, don't get flooded. And Treasure Island is also building up higher, and we purposefully did not build on the western side of the island. In fact, if you look at the development, it's all heavily concentrated on the side closest to the Bay Bridge. And what we are putting on the other side is more marshland and wetlands to absorb in the time of rising tides. But San Francisco is participating in the resiliency efforts that the Rockefeller Foundation has been funding across the country. We all need to play a role. I also strongly support divesting from fossil fuels. Divesting pension funds from fossil fuels, because we just can't be investing in these corporations that are contributing to the exact things that you're talking about that are going to ruin our city in the long term.
We have a couple emails about concerns over toxic waste at Treasure Island. We have the story that's breaking about Hunter's Point. I just want to read a headline from Curb. Fraud coupled with contamination discovers fuel. Doubt calls to test area. The Navy may have stored radioactive chemicals and ran radiation lab on Hilltop area that was long assured to be clean. Whistleblowers say they discovered toxic contamination.
I have to say I was shocked when I read the news that a federal contractor is lying to the federal government about how it is cleaning up land, which directly impacts the health and well-being of our residents. And it certainly raised an eyebrow because the same company, while playing a different role in Treasure Island, is playing a role in the Treasure Island cleanup. Treasure Island is a Superfund site. The land cannot be conveyed from the Navy to the city until the land is fully cleaned. And given what we're seeing at Hunter's Point, we are taking a sharper focus and paying more attention to the work that our federal contractors are now doing to clean up our land, both in the shipyards and Treasure Island. But what happened over the last couple of months is completely unacceptable. I'm incredibly thankful to the whistleblowers who courageously let the public know that this was happening and we have to fix this.
We have a call, Andy from Redwood City. Hi, Andy. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Right. Good morning. Yeah, Ms. Kim, your conversation about Uber and Lyft, I was surprised you didn't take a stronger stance against both those companies. The gig economy is no good for workers. It's pretty abusive. It hurts the environment to have all those Uber and Lyft drivers running around. Many European cities have taken a strong stance against Uber and Lyft, considering them as taxi cab companies, which I believe they are taxi cab companies, and should be regulated as taxi cab companies. And Ms. Kim, I really wish you do become mayor. I think you're a great candidate, and I think you have done a lot for the city, and I think you'll do more if you do become mayor, and best of luck to you.
Thank you, Andy. I really appreciate your feedback and comment. And I do want to regulate Uber and Lyft, and I do wish we could treat them as taxi cabs. We are preempted by the California state constitution from doing so, but we're certainly lobbying heavily in Sacramento to change that direction in due course. But I really appreciate your positive feedback.
Thank you, Andy. We're actually trying to get the California PUC to come on the show to talk about regulating Uber and Lyft. So we will have that hopefully soon. Jane, we have just a couple minutes left, but I want to ask you a question about education because you did serve on the Board of Education. We're seeing teacher strikes across the country. We've had teachers in San Francisco on the show who say that they cannot make ends meet. They, too, are bringing food in for their classrooms. There's also very big gaps in learning when you look at students of color versus white students. I mean, these are almost shocking achievement gaps. Mm-hmm. They're, in some cases, 69 points when you look at English proficiency tests. Mm-hmm. How do you plan to tackle the education crisis?
So what what is called the achievement gap, we like to call the opportunity gap, because if you look at the test scores, the greater predictor, of course, is race and income and opportunities that are provided those families. If you live in a neighborhood where if you live in a household that is housing insecure, food insecure, and perhaps where there's a lot of violence, it is just more difficult to learn and to be successful in a school environment. Whereas if you live in a stable home with two parents that are working and your parents read to you every night and make sure you're doing your homework, you're going to be likely more successful. The city has a lot of work to do in addressing this economic divide here in our city. And that is the way we need to partner with our public schools, is to actually help address the issues that are happening outside of the classroom. And one thing that I hear all the time from teachers is that they are no longer just educators. They are now social workers, they're counselors, they're mediators, they're nurses, and they're also taking care of the parents. And so we need to make sure that teachers get to focus on actually teaching, which is what we train teachers to do. And the city should be able to help by providing more mental health support, counselors, resources, social workers to the schools. And I really love the concept that the teachers union is currently pushing, which is the idea of community schools, where the city provides resources to make sure that we have very strong wraparound services for students and their families on site where they go, so that we can allow students to learn.
And those services cost money.
They do. They absolutely do. But I think it's a worthwhile investment in our city. You know, people talk a lot about public safety. And one of the best things that we can do to address public safety is to invest in our schools.
Jane Kim is running for mayor of San Francisco. In 2010, she was elected to represent District 6 on the Board of Supervisors. Early voting has begun. Learn more about ranked choice voting at yourcallradio.org. And please spread the word. If you're not registered, you can register. Mayor Kim, thank you so much for coming in. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much for having me, Rose. It's always a pleasure. And thank you to all the listeners.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. This is Your Call.